So as Linda said, my name is Darren Kirapapa. I'm a consultant with Manitoba Education this year. I started them officially in September, unofficially in July. And it's supposed to be a two-year secondment, but due to shrinking budgets, my secondment is in June. So I'll be back in the classroom in September. This presentation is called What Can I Do Now? And from your perspective, and it's called Web 2.0 Pedagogy. It's while we may look at a lot of different tools and digital tools, that's not the focus at all. The focus is very much on pedagogy and on student learning and ways in which students can demonstrate what they know. But we'll get into that in more depth as we go along. So if there's one note you need to take down, if there's one little bit of information you need, this is it. That's the only thing you need to know. This is a wiki where I have archived all the presentations that I've done for Manitoba Education since August, actually, all the way through to now, are archived here. So it's SciICT, Senior Years ICT. I actually have three areas of responsibility at the ministry. I'm responsible for the Senior Years ICT curriculum, Infusion of the Senior Years, Computer Science, and Business and Management Education. Not too busy. Anyways, so that's the wiki. And if you go there, this is what it looks like. And it's actually a little clearer on the screen now. That's good. So when you land there, this is the front page. If you need to get a hold of me afterwards, then there's the contact information, email address, telephone numbers, etc. And if you scroll down, these are all the presentations I've done. Each one of those is a link to a page. But the bottom one, the one that says March 10th, that's for today. And that's the presentation for today. So you'll have the slides. All these slides are clickable. If you click on the right-hand side of the slide, it advances forward. If you click on the left, it goes back. But everything that's a link, if you just keep in the center, so a lot of the resources that I'm going to share with you, I've linked out to them. So if I clicked on that, it would actually link back, well, in this case, it would just link back to the wiki. So it's all there. I'm recording the audio for this session. I've got a recording from this morning's audio as well. I'll post both of them. And so you can, if there's something that you need to go back over, you can. You'll be able to download it and then, you know, move through it at whatever pace is good for you. Okay? So with that said, here's the primary question that I want to deal with, which is, how do you know what they know? How do any of us know what they know? And when I talk to teachers, and certainly when I talk to my students in the classroom like this now, well, you know, I'm actually going to reserve that comment for later. Let's start with the little video. Watch this, and then I'd like to know your impressions of it, okay? I'll tell you one more thing about my background. Where I was teaching was Daniel McIntyre Collegiate Institute. It's a grade 9 to 12 high school. I was the department head of mathematics there since 2000, 2001. And so I often like talking to my teachers because I feel like I'm talking to my people. But with that said, when I watch this video in particular, as a math teacher, it really makes me upset. Every time. I've seen it a lot of times. Why? Why do you think, or how do you feel about watching that?
Other ways to assess are going to be as effective and maybe as quick. Like ultimately, if you want to find out if a kid knows what they know, show them.
Right.
That's the quickest way, and it's,
yeah.
I'm sure if it's the most effective way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you feel after watching that video? Is that any pushback from you at all? What do you think is the point of the video, to agree, disagree?
Testing doesn't tell you what they know. I mean, they may have been unlucky and hit the wrong percentage of the test, or they may have been very lucky and hit the right percentage. That's what it says. What it says is the amount or the percentage that they know that you wanted to ask them.
Yeah. I'm thinking of like testing, but it's a dipstick. Like what's happening today, right now, at this moment, you want to take a dipstick and bring the kids write a quiz and test that sort of thing. But I often wonder, like, what if, I come from an inner city school, so we've got kids that come from all kinds of backgrounds, right? And if the day the kids write the test happens to be the night after mom and dad are up all night arguing, and that's what they're coming to school with. No, that's not really their chance to show their best work. And, the problem we have with tests, of course, is like, how many of you have this? So the kid, student writes the test, right? And you mark it and give it back to them. And the kid says, oh, damn, I knew that. I know it now, right? If I could do that again, I would get it right. And you, as the teacher, we have that conversation. So you would know what to do now, right? You learned something from that experience. And they say, usually, they say, yes, right? If not, then you have that conversation. Has that ever happened to you in your class? Anybody? Okay, here's the thing with that, though, is that when we get to the end of a course of study, we have to assign a single numeric grade that is supposed to represent the sum total of knowledge, competence, capacity that the student has developed in their time with us. And that mark, by and large, is supposed to represent what they've learned. And that mark is, by and large, based on those tests. Didn't they learn something afterwards? And it's a problem because what are you supposed to do? Like, you can't keep retesting and retesting and retesting. There's no time for that. And there's also no time to keep going over the same material again and again. So what are you supposed to do? In the video, they show some examples of kids showing what they know. Do you remember what the examples were?
Sports, music,
performance, right? It makes me nuts. Like, okay. I don't take anything away from our colleagues that teach phys ed, or that our colleagues that teach the performing arts, okay? Because they do fantastic work. That's why they end up on stage, right? When the kids have some production to do, dance classes, drama classes, music, the choir, whatever, those kids know we do a really good job of creating stages for our performers and our athletes. They are regularly on stage where they get to show what they know, and everybody can see it. And the kids know they're going to be on stage. They work doubly hard to make sure that they've got that stuff down because they know they're going to perform and they're going to be seen by an audience. And what bugs me about this is, where are the academic stages? Like, if you've got a kid who really digs math and sports isn't their thing, where is the stage for that kid? People usually at this point tell me math contests. How often is that? That happen with the same frequency as sports, the performing arts, the choir. Where are the stages where our kids get to show what they know? Anyways, I hope before we get to the end of this presentation that I'm going to try to answer that question. Okay? How do we know what they know? Have any of you seen this book, read this book? It's called How People Learn. Anybody? Okay. It's linked. You can read it for free online. What this book is, this is, for me, reading this was seminal. This rocked my world. This changed the way I think about teaching. What they did was they went and they looked at a series of studies. They examined over years and years, what do we know about how it is that people go about the business of learning anything? And so it was published in, I think it was 1997 that it was first published and then updated again in 2000. Okay? And what they came away from is there's basically three fundamental principles that guide how people learn anything. And as an outgrowth of that book, they wrote this other book called How Students Learn, Math, Science, and History. And they specifically looked at those areas. How do kids learn those subjects? And what came out of them was basically three principles. Three kind of rules of thumb that dictate how it is, not dictate, but that that it is the fact, and from the empirical evidence, that's how people go about learning. So I'm going to share with you those three principles of how kids learn. And then I want to share with you three instructional practices. Each of those practices embeds those three principles. Okay? And then we'll look at some concrete examples. So here's the first one out of the book. Okay? And the first one out of the book is kids don't arrive in any classroom as a tabula rasa. They don't arrive not knowing anything. They actually bring some kind of preconception to the table. Something. Like in science. The example I gave this morning was, in science we tell them that the world is round. Is that really how it looks to you? Like when you walk about your day, does it look round? Does it look like you're walking around on a ball? Because they usually think that the world is flat, and it's not an unreasonable thing for them to think. And so when they come to class and we tell them the world is round, so they went and they studied, so what do the kids think now, right? We told them the world is round. It turns out that their mental picture of the world is a giant pancake. Now, knowing that informs you, if you're a science teacher, it kind of informs how you want to instruct your kids. If you know that's the preconception they're bringing to the class, then that informs your instruction. And we have to wonder, what are the things that they bring to the class? The example I have up here is fractions. We all know, right? The bane of kids and math teachers and people in general everywhere. Because early on, in the early years, we teach kids that multiplication is repeated addition. Multiplication is not repeated addition, but that's what we teach them in the early years, right? And it's a good place to start, don't get me wrong, right? I wouldn't start somewhere else. I wouldn't start by telling kids it's repeated addition. For example, another example I gave earlier was, my son came home, he was in grade 1 or 2, and he said, Dad, what's a decimal number? So my answer to him was, well, a decimal number is the way we write a number that's smaller than 1 and bigger than 0. What do you think of that answer?
It's a good starting point, but it's really
not. Yeah, right. Like, we can start talking about repeating decimals, we can talk about non-repeating decimals, we can talk about irrational numbers and their decimal representation. We can talk about, you know, 1.2 is a number bigger than 1, and it's a decimal. So it was -3.4. So is pi and e are both transcendental numbers represented as decimals. Like, I could have gone into all that, but he was grade 1. Like, it's the first step.
Okay?
It's a good place to start, but then you want to bring them forward. And I actually told them that. I said, look, I'm not lying to you. There's a lot more to say about this, but to begin, let's just say it's a number, way to write a number between 0 and 1, and later on we'll keep talking and you'll learn that there's more to it. So with multiplication, often kids, many kids often make this mistake because they've learned it's repeated addition. So the answer has to be bigger than any of the numbers I started off with. And they look at that and they forget about the fraction. There's a 2 and a 3, it's got to be 6, right? Because they think of it as, and if that's the preconception that they arrive in class with, then that's the starting point for us as their teachers. The second principle right out of the book is that, is to learn ideas that knowledge is networked. Knowledge, like, we often teach things kind of hierarchical, and in fact, knowledge is, the things that you know are not arranged in a nice hierarchy. So I'll give you another example, 3/4. When I say to you 3/4, what does that mean?
Three-quarters of a mile.
Okay, 3/4 of something, so a block. Anybody else?
75 cents.
75 cents, right? Could have been talking about through the coins, right? What else?
75%.
75%.
3 out of 4 things.
3 out of 4 things. Or maybe I've got 3 red Smarties and you have 2 blue Smarties, and the ratio there is 3 to 4. That's different, isn't it? Because the fraction of red Smarties is 3/7. The ratio is 3 to 4. No wonder kids are confused, right? Because now, what if I said to you, there's no, the notion of three-quarters actually lives, you know, it could mean lots of different things in different contexts, right? And that's how we, as experts, when we think about it, that's how we think about it, right? We think of it as, we already have that network of understanding. Can I borrow your pencil for a second?
Sure.
So, this is, what teachers, not just teachers, anybody who knows something, who has some bit of knowledge, suffers from what's called recursive knowledge. Is that you know it so well, right, that it seems things are self-evident to you. Here's a little experiment for you, okay? I'm going to tap out a song, and I want you, I'm just going to tap it out, and I want you to tell me what song am I tapping out, okay? Anybody?
You're in a little lamb.
Okay. Did everybody think that's what it was?
This old man.
I was ready for this morning.
Sorry. Yeah, I changed it.
It's going on a snap all around.
So this, I'll say this morning, okay? Anybody else? What did you think it was?
I thought it was
Mary Had a Little Lamb. You thought?
This old man.
This old man. Did anybody agree?
I thought Baba Blacks here.
Baba Blacks.
Well, everybody here still want to hear.
I didn't know.
But that was the no clue. Next year, how many people had no bloody idea? Okay. Yeah.
Now, I'm pretty sure I just
one second.
Sound.
How many people had no bloody idea? Put your hands up high again. Look around the room. Okay? This morning I tapped out Frère Jacques and I knew that they had heard that.
Yeah.
Suffering from recursive knowledge, they missed this one completely because that's what they were listening to.
Our preconception.
Okay? Well, I was tapping out Mary Had a Little Lamb. You guys. Okay?
I missed the first part.
Because when I'm tapping it, I can hear it in my head. It makes total sense to me, okay, that that's what I'm tapping out. It does not make sense to someone who's being exposed to it for the first time. There's always a few, right, those few that sometimes we say they learn in spite of us, right? It doesn't matter what you do, that kid's going to learn. But we suffer from the curse. It makes so much sense. Like for me, how did you miss that? It was so clear to me that I was tapping Mary Had a Little, because the music was playing in my head, right? Often when we're teaching, the music is playing in our heads, and the kids are not hearing what we're hearing. So knowledge, the example again of three-quarters, it doesn't live in isolation of other ideas. It's actually living in this network. And if you were to kind of draw a map of kind of how it's connected, you'd have all kinds of lines messily connecting this idea and that idea together, right? And in fact, that's how we think about it. Like when I say to you orange, what am I talking about? I'll save you the grief, okay, because whatever you say, I'm saying about it. Okay? So if you'd said the fruit, I was going to say the color. If you'd said the color, I was going to say the fruit. How, now, what if I say that the oranges we had at the snack today were fantastic? Now what am I talking about? Well, it's very clear. Why? It's context. It's the context. But the kids don't have that context. We do, and we have to help them build the context and understand how all these ideas are connected one to the other. And to teach them three-quarters, like why fractions are so hard, is because you keep learning that it's one thing. And three-quarters is not one thing. It depends on what context you're in. You need to be explicit about that. And it's not just that our knowledge, our understandings of how different ideas are connected, actually are connected in networks, it's also the way we learn through social networks. Do you remember your student teaching? Like, I remember mine. I remember that first day. I remember really clear because I came home and said, like, what kind of moron am I? Like, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life? Like, you got to be an idiot. Like, well, who's going to brutalize themselves, right? But you get to the end, and you kind of accommodate it, right? Now, there's only one thing harder than student teaching. And do you know what it is? One thing harder than student teaching.
Actually teaching
your first
full
year
time.
Yeah, you do it full time for the first year, like weren't you run ragged, like up all night, like and even after you've been teaching for a while, what happens if you get a new course to teach, what you've never taught before, new content you're not familiar with? It takes time, like that's hard. And when you have a wicked problem, and teaching is a wicked problem, okay? When you have a wicked problem to solve that's difficult, Is it typically your habit to go sit in the corner and think hard until you figure it out? Or do you do something else?
After thinking hard, then I do something.
What do you do?
Then I consult.
Who? Is it who or what?
So first what?
Okay.
Who is always my last? But that's me.
Okay.
Who is always my last?
Okay.
I tend to be very private and independent, so I sit there and I put myself in my little cave and I'll, I've been working so the library online and source information before I actually talk to you. Then if it gets to the point where I can't solve it, so is the information available, then I will talk to
you. Okay. Does anybody have a different process?
Like the opposite.
Yeah.
Daryl.
You asked Daryl? I mean, look, if there's a new teacher in the school, right, they're brand new to the building, new to the division, maybe, whatever it is, they're teaching a bunch of courses they've never taught before, you give them a bunch of stuff, but don't you also talk to them? And if you have a new course, don't you go find the teachers that have taught that course and say, well, what did you do? Or if you're teaching like a particularly difficult unit, like, okay, I got to teach this unit on logarithms. Logarithms are wicked hard to teach. Like, kids struggle like nobody's business with logarithms, right? You ever had a conversation with a colleague? It doesn't have to be logarithms, but whatever. And how did you teach that? Is knowing a thing, like, okay, is this true? Knowing a thing and teaching a thing, is that the same thing? Which one?
It's interesting because just an example that was an email, and I think for grade 9 teachers, one of the teachers the other day just said, I've just finished this part of the new curriculum and deciding what to do next, what did you guys do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because real learning, right, aside from the fact that the knowledge is networked, has to do with the social aspect, the way we communicate with each other. Right? Like, it's the knowledge is not in our hands, it's between us, it's in the conversations that we have. Sometimes, like, okay, if you've ever gone to a conference, tell me, the best part of any professional development is the coffee break. Yeah? And it's not the coffee. It's not the coffee that's good. Has this been your experience? Or? Yeah? Why? What happens at the coffee break?
Talk to all the people or something.
Right? Like, if the presenter was worthwhile, then maybe they pushed your thinking in some way, and you need that coffee break because that's where you're actually going to talk about it. And say, well, this is what I heard. And we all have different perspectives on things. We may have heard different things, right? You all heard different things when I tapped it out, right? So those conversations are really important. And that's where knowledge really lives. That it lives between us. It's not in our hands. So that was the second principle. Learning is network. Third is metacognition. That we really learn things deeply when we are in situations where we have to think about what we're learning as we're learning. And I don't mean saying to a bunch of kids, okay guys, now reflect. Because that's phony. Like, what does that mean, reflect? Instead, saying to a kid, okay, was the part of this easy for you? Was part of this difficult? Which parts, and what's the difference? And this is getting to Marzano's 9 strategies. The number one strategy, most effective teaching strategy, is to have kids compare similarities and differences. Right. That moves kids 1.6 standard deviations on average forward in terms of their success, their achievement. So was this difficult? What was the difficult part? Did you have a part where finally everything clicked for you? Was there a moment where something happened or had a conversation with someone, whatever it was, and it just made sense? Okay, what was it? What sparked that off? Can you describe what that felt like and what pushed you or what was the tipping point for you? These are the kinds of questions that you ask. And coming up with these questions, by the way, is not easy. That's the heavy lifting of doing that metacognitive component of what we teach. It's not easy to come up with good reflection questions. It's tough. So these are the three pedagogical principles, okay? Number one is connect with the kids' preconceptions. What is it that they're bringing to the table? Number two, knowledge is network. Not just conceptually, but building that social aspect as well. I often say to my students, I say it over and over again. If you're not talking to somebody about it, you're not learning it. And number three is the metacognitive aspect. There's got to be some element in there somewhere at some point where the kids are reflecting on what they're learning as they're learning. Okay? So those are the three out of the book. Those are the three principles. Then I want to share with you three instructional design practices that embody those three principles. And then we'll look at how they're applied concretely. So when you go to an art gallery, the nice thing with an art gallery is everybody gets to walk around and see the artist's work. But what the work means to each person, to each viewer, is different. Now, right now, as I look out at you, so there's about, I don't know, 10 or 15 people, I've got no idea if anything that I'm saying to you is actually resonating with you, is addressing a concern that you have, is meaningful, am I wasting your time? Do you regret having made the time to be here today? But I've got no idea what's going on behind your eyes. And I have the same problem in every class that I teach. And I really need to see what's going on, especially for my students, what's going on behind their eyes. Without knowing what's going on behind their eyes, I can't get at those preconceptions to make those changes that need to be changed. Because now we know that in the brain, when you learn a thing, whether you learn it properly or not, when you learn a thing, there's the pathway in your brain gets coated with a chemical called myelin. And if you repeat that thing, it gets coated with myelin again. And the more often you do that thing, the more coatings of myelin you get there, and that's how you learn that thing. What you might have learned was a wrong thing, but that's what you've learned now. And you see kids, I taught you how to do this, we know, and they do the same mistake again and again and again because they originally learned it the wrong way. We've got to find a way to see what's going on behind their eyes. And it's not just that I need to see behind their eyes, because I want them to see behind mine. I want them to see how I think of things. The example I give is, you ever walk into a class, put a problem on the board to which you don't know the answer, and then try to solve it for your students, talking out loud as you're doing it, messing up, you know, getting, and don't put a challenging problem for yourself, so that the kids can watch how you deal with that. Right? Because when you get it wrong, how do I know? Like, how do I know I made a mistake? How do I know that, now I've got the right answer? How do you know that? Don't they need to know that too? They need to see what's going on inside your head. Now the thing is, you're an expert. And while it's important that they have those expert models, they're not experts. They're novices. So more importantly, they need to see how a novice is learning. They need to see what's going on inside each other's heads. We need to create these galleries of thought where kids can see what's going on inside each other's heads, and they can see what's going on inside our heads, and we can see what's going on inside their heads. So that's the first practice. That gets at it, shows their preconceptions, if you can see what they're thinking. And if you create a gallery for the kids to walk in, then they start networking, and they see, and maybe talking about it, right? And of course, there's inevitably a reflective component built into having the kids see how other people think about the same thing they're thinking, particularly if there's differences. The second instructional practice is publish everything. Everything. Like, everything your kids do should be public. Like, everything kids do in class is precious. If it's not, why did you ask them to do it? And shouldn't that be published and shared? Right? So that everybody can see exactly what it is that they're doing. And if what you're asking them to do in class is the kind of stuff that can be thrown away, then that should still be published, because that should be documented so that we can reflect on it and change. Right? We need to be able to see these galleries of thought. Where are you going to put it? You're going to put it when you publish it, when other people can see it. I'll show you what I mean by this in a little more detail. Here's an example. There's a grade 5 class in New York. It's a true story. The teacher has the choir teacher, he's got a blog, and he just habitually videotapes the kids as they sing various songs, and then they publish it on the class blog, and the families can all see their little sons and daughters singing, okay? So, I want you to watch this. This is a song, this is one of the songs. It's Landslide by Stevie Nicks. I'm gonna tell you the backstory to this, but what I want you to pay attention in the video is, watch their bodies, watch how they're moving, and the best part of this video, the very best part happens at the very, very end.
Thank you.
know, just from the way those kids move, right? Like, that's authentic. Like, the kids are into it. There's even this one girl that's like, she's so serious. She has real serious look on her face. She's singing. And there's a moment in the video where a little girl in the front, like, sorry, rewind the race. I'll come back to a little girl. At the end, right, when the teacher turns around, and he looks right in the camera and he says, "That was good," right? Like, that was my favorite part of the whole video. Because so much of being a good teacher, and I'm pretty sure he knows, is packed into that. Like, we know that in our classrooms, when students and teachers are getting along, and there's a good vibe between students and teachers, lots of learning happens in the room. But when there's conflict, when there's tension between teacher and students, that's when learning stops. And oftentimes, the relationship that we have with our students is so important to helping them be successful. I remember when my very first teaching job, I was hired in the middle of the school year, and I was replacing another teacher who was absolutely adored by his students and was retiring. And it wasn't a semester in the school year, it was a full year. So I come in right in the middle, right? This novice, neophyte, nobody, walks into the class replacing this man that they absolutely love. And I remember this department head sat me down and he said, "Give them a quiz, give it to them soon, and make sure they all get 100%. What? He said, "Yeah, the first thing you have to do with them is convince them that they can learn from you. Then you can get into the more hard stuff." Right? And he, kind of in that little statement, he really encapsulated, like, establish that strong relationship first and then everything comes from that. The little girl that I was talking about in the front row, like, there's a line in the song that I built my love around you, and she points at her teacher. Right? Like, that was really powerful for me. You can tell that they obviously love him, he loves them, and look at the great stuff that they can do with that. Anyways, so here's this teacher, he's just taking videos, and puts them on YouTube, and he embed them on the blog, and it's just really the school community, right? The families that are watching him. Stevie Nicks is on tour, and these guys are in New York, and the tour manager stumbles upon this video on YouTube, and is floored by the kid's performance. So he says, Stevie, you gotta see this. He sits her down in front of the computer. He says, "Watch." And she watches the video twice, bawling her eyes out, okay, watching the kids sing. Because the teacher has a blog, this online presence, they're able to get in touch with him, an email exchange goes on back and forth. One thing leads to another. The kids, the entire class, is invited to Madison Square Gardens to sing for Stevie Nicks at the sound check. And oops, I always do that. Let me show you. And at one point, while the kids are on stage singing with Stevie Nicks, Matt, if you imagine your body sitting at Madison Square Gardens, and then Stevie Nicks stands up, and she's in the audience, and she's conducting the class, right, as they're all singing. You can't plan lessons like that. You can't. It's not possible. So when they're finished singing, we won't get to watch the whole video, but when they're finished singing, the tour manager, or the stage manager, he wants them off the stage. They've got to show that, right? Stevie's done it before. They want him off the stage, and she's saying, "No, leave them there." And she goes up on stage, just each and every single kid, and she gives every kid a hug and says over and over again, "Dreams can come true. Don't get let go of your dreams." She says to every kid. The comment most often made by the kids after that, "She smells so nice." Anyways, so the kids have this experience, right? Now, I didn't tell this part of the story in the morning, but I'll tell you guys. So she does, this happens to this class, right? They get to see this thing with Stevie, they perform in front of Stevie, the whole ball wax, they're invited there. They're incredibly popular now, and they have sung with all kinds of big name performers, to the point now they have more requests from performers who want to sing with them than they can fulfill. And if you go visit their blog, which is still there online, you'll see all the people they sang with. I remember there's one there by David Hasselhoff says, "If you guys ever want to sing with me, let me know." I had a David, but you know, maybe he should offer them instead of anyways. Anyways, the point that I just want to make with this is why I publish kids' work. Because you can't plan lessons like that. And while you can create a community around whatever it is that you publish about them, by having it online and creating that authentic audience that may go beyond the little communities in which we teach, we open the door to serendipity. If you don't, then that door stays closed and things like this can't happen. Galleries of thought, how that connects to the three principles from the book. Publishing everything. Because it's published, and you can see how you can't tear that apart really from creating galleries of thought, but publishing everything allows you to see their preconceptions, allows them to build those, to demonstrate their understanding of those knowledge networks, but connect socially. And if they're publishing it, then they've got to create something. Okay? They've got to, it forces them to think about what they're learning because I'm going to publish it. So what is it that I'm publishing? The last instructional practice is you want your kids to create content that educates. Now the reason you want to do that is because you've all seen this, right? So Bloom's taxonomy, this goes back to, well, it goes back a while, but in 2000 it was updated. So at the top used to be evaluate, and underneath that was synthesize, right? So synthesize is out, evaluate's pushed down, create is at the top. And the reason is because you got lower order thinking skills when you've got kids operating at the bottom of Bloom's taxonomy, right? Cognitively, they're just remembering and understanding stuff. That's not as deep thought as applying the knowledge, analyzing, evaluating, right? And you want to push kids to think at the top of the triangle. And I never liked the way it was drawn, so I redrew it like this, because I think that more properly emphasizes what we should be doing with kids in classrooms, right? Creation is really what it's all about. When you have kids create content that educates, that necessarily entails that they remember, understand, apply, analyze, and evaluate the material that they're producing. So what does all that look like in practice? So I'll show you some examples. Some of these are small examples. They take place over a short period of time. Others are longer, maybe take place over a full semester. So this is what I call mind map. I like mind maps because when you get, it gets to that networked idea, right? Where we can see how the kids think of ideas and how they're related one to the other. But what I asked my kids to do was to create digital mind maps. So this is an example from a grade 11 pre-calculus class. And we just finished a course of study on quadratics. And what the kids had to do is they took their cell phones and they went out into the world and had to find a real world picture of quadratics in their lives. Somewhere. They weren't able to take another, they had to take the picture, they had to create the image. And then once they took the picture, then they had to upload it to a website called Flickr. How many people have heard of Flickr? It's a photo sharing website. You take pictures and you put them up there. What's nice about Flickr is that it has this ability that you can add notes so that when I move my mouse over the picture, you can see all these hot spots. And what she had to do is she had to summarize everything she learned in that unit on quadratics. So this is, as you can see, I put a Cartesian plane on top of my photo. It will help locate roots, vertex, axis of symmetry. So at this point, she's got the vertex, so she's looking at a parabola opening down. Coordinate, the vertex is at HK, and she goes on to describe everything that she's learned in this unit on quadratics. She's found a root, she explains roots, x-intercept, zeros, and what she's done here is she's encapsulated everything that she's learned in that unit on quadratics. Okay, that's good, but that's not enough. Because all that is that one girl summarizing what she knows. And now I can see a little bit about how she thinks, but that's not enough. That's why it's on Flickr. Because then on the classroom blog, you've got a little badge that aggregates all those pictures. They link out so the other kids now can come here and they can see what she thinks. For her own learning, I want her to see how her classmates solve this same problem, the mind maps that they created, so that they can have that novice's insight into how another novice thinks about doing this. Over here on the side, you see it has tags. So quadratic, I call that the assignment tag, because this particular assignment was on quadratic, so we tagged it quadratic. The other tag, if you look at it, can you see it? Can you see that one? Okay. So that one says PC30SF06. You may be able to piece together what that means. She was in my grade 11 pre-calculus class. That was pre-calc 30S, and she took it with me in the fall semester of 2006. Now, that particular combination of letters and numbers is not like, it's not likely that there's other people in the world using that particular combination, right? Like tagging stuff that way. So I'm pretty confident that that's uniquely my students from my class that I taught in that semester, right? So my tag is scalable. So when I teach the same course the following semester, it's PC30SW07. That's how I do it. You should think for yourself, like it should connect to your class and should be scalable from year to year. Because when it comes time for me to find out what the whole class has done, then all I do is I click on the tag, or actually go to Flickr and I search. This is just, these are all the pictures that her acronym is Sherry. The kids don't publish their names. They use first names or just aliases, right? No last names. And they're not allowed to take pictures of themselves, by the way. Look how she dealt with that. I was really proud of her. Okay, they're not allowed to take a picture that includes their face. So if I want to see all public content tagged with that, that's everything in that class. All the kids in that class, this is the work that they've produced. This one, that's actually a straw. The kid folds it up into that shape, and then she finds all this trigonometry all over the place with it, and she labels points A, B, C, D, and then she tells us about it, and she links out to exterior sites so she's gone off and done a little research on that. So when we did the unit on trigonometry, I want this girl, right, to show the other kids what she thought, but I want other kids to see what she thought. I want her to see what the other kids thought, etc. Does that make sense? So that's just one of the assignments. Okay, another one that in mathematics we have solution language, right? Usually you have maybe one in the class, and kids very rarely look at it. They look to see how those things are solved step by step. Sometimes we give them to them. I know like in the grade 12, I gave the kid the full set of solutions if I could get them in pre-cal.
You also have that site you showed in the morning at Byte where they can go get every solution to everything.
Yeah, you should talk to them. You've heard
that
of Wolfram Alpha?
You're going to have to show them, I think.
Yeah. Have you heard of Wolfram Alpha? Okay, go ahead and leave what they're talking about. Okay, we'll do that later. So I thought, well, a lot of kids don't read the solution manual. So instead of having the kids read the solution manual, I thought I'd have them write it. So what I did is every class has to write the solution manual that goes with, I actually have them write the textbook too. That's a different topic. So each of these badges is a different class. So I'll show you this one. This is my AP Calculus class from 08-09. How many people know what a wiki is? Okay. How many people have heard of Wikipedia? Okay. So what basically all wiki is, okay, it's a real simple thing. It's a web page, which when you go there, there's a button that says edit. You click that button, and now you can type, just like in a word processor. When you're finished, if there's nothing on the page, and you click edit, and you type your stuff, you're making an original contribution of content to that page. You click save, and you're done. That's it. That's the first thing wiki does. You can very easily put content on a web page like that. Okay. Edit, type, save, done. The second thing a wiki does, someone else who comes to the page you just created sees your stuff and says, oh, actually I have a little bit more to say about that. And they click edit and they add some more stuff. They're, oh, spelling error, let me fix that. And they click save and they're done. And that's it. They've just made a modification to pre-existing content. That's all a wiki does. That's it. You either make an original content contribution or you modify content that's already there. That's it. That's what we teach. So the question then is, though, so how does that find its way pedagogically into the way that I teach my kids in my classroom, incorporating the ideas that we talked about earlier? So what I did was I said, okay, I'm going to give the kids, I took this wiki and I seeded the wiki with exam-level problems. One problem on each page. And then what the kids had to do is they had 2 weeks to do this assignment, week one. They have to make a significant contribution. The significant contribution is to find one problem in the wiki, come in, solve that problem, show all the steps, and annotate the solution well enough so that an interested learner can learn from you. And say your work. Done. That's it, week one. So I gave them a week to do one problem. Realistically, that could have been an overnight assignment. I could have given them a lot more than one problem to do overnight. One problem. Okay, exam level question. Week two, the kids think is easier, I think is much harder, and they usually agree with me by the time they get to the end of week two. The hardest, I'll tell you what the hardest thing in a second. So week two, what they have to do, they come back to the wiki and they have to edit someone's work, not their own. They have to find an error that someone else has made somewhere and fix it. Make it better. If you can't find any errors anywhere, then do something that improves this entire product in some significant way. Make a constructive modification to what was already there. Now give them a week to do that. I give them 2 weeks for this because it's supposed to be low pressure. It's done leading up to the exam. It's always done before the final exam. And it's supposed to be an opportunity for the kids to really learn. Now, they think the first week is the hard week because they have to solve this problem and annotate it. The second week is the real hard work because they have to go read everybody else's work and then figure out, is that right or wrong? And if it's wrong, then how do I fix it? So they probably took what was the easiest problem for them to solve in the first week. In the second week, they're having to correct problems that they didn't think were the easiest problems to solve. That makes sense? Okay. Hardest thing for the teacher is to be quiet. Don't say anything. Because in week one, all those things, when you said, we talked about that, why are you doing that again? All that stuff, why don't they do it again and again and again? And if you say something, right, if you say to your students, you've made an error there, then you've interfered with the process, right? That week two is really where the learning comes in, right? Week two is the one that's got the most educational learning juice for the kids, because that's when they have to reflect on everything that they've learned. So let me show you what one of these questions looks like, and I'll show you kind of how I assess it. So here's a question. This was an exam level question. I just copied it and put it in here. Then you see we have a quick find code for the problem. It uses the quick key typing for that's built into Firefox. We've got a legend, so kid is using green, blue, red, and purple text in different ways to mean different things. They've included equations, etc. There's a graph that they've included on and on. There's an image, right? Red indicates its upper function outside. Blue is the lower one inside. I'm going to come back to that picture in a sec. And on and on and on. This is just one question, and this is the kid's full solution. So since this is a combination of the stuff I seeded, the stuff the kid solved, and then other kids came and modified it, how do I know who did what? Well, every page in a wiki, no matter what the wiki is, it's got a page history button. And if I click on the page history button, it shows me all the revisions that were made in that wiki. So if I go all the way to the bottom, see, this is all me seeding the original problem, right? And then I see that a student named Jamie has come in and she claims that problem, she solved it. So her last edit is here, and she made that edit at 10:57 and 46 seconds on April 19th. Like, you know exactly, the kids can't handle it working late if you set a deadline for something. So if I wanna see, okay, so what did Jamie do? What does Jamie's work look like? Well, there it is, this is Jamie's work. So she's the one that came up with that legend, but the quick find code isn't there, someone else did that. And as I keep scrolling down, so she's done a lot of the heavy lifting here. She's got these dotted lines separating section. There's the image she put in, but that's not the image we just saw, is it? You remember it was red and blue, and it was pointing outer, and then lower was inside, and she's got this wrong, actually. Right? So she's got it wrong, and it's not well designed. It was better when it was in two different colors. Okay? So, okay, fine. So who did what? Well, I see that after Jamie, I'm going to click on Jamie here, and then I'm going to see, here's Zeph. Zeph's last edit is there. And I want to compare the difference in edits between the two students. So I click on the compare, and the green stuff is the stuff that Zeph added, and the red stuff is the stuff that Zeph deleted. And I can see that Zeph has actually made a constructive modification, and if I want to see specifically what's different about Zeph's work, I can now zoom in and look at if he's included any other images and whatnot. When I do that, and I scroll down, so Zeph has moved things forward, but that picture, he didn't get that right. He didn't catch that error, and he certainly didn't fix it. So when I go back and I look at the history, I can see that this Benjamin makes one change, only one. So I'm wondering, gee, you know, like, you got to put in a significant amount of work. If you do squat, if you do something lame, then you're not going to get any marks. And when I compare, you know, Zeph's last edit to Benjamin's, I see that Benjamin's taken out the dotted lines. He didn't like them. Well, that's not worth anything. That's like, what was that for? So, but okay, but let me also just take a quick look at what Benjamin added to the question. So as I scroll down, and I'm looking, and I notice here, oh, Benjamin caught that error, and he uploaded the picture and fixed it. I can actually pick out exactly who did what and exactly when they did it.
so I can assess the kids. And the rubric that I've used, actually, the rubric that I designed with the kids is there. And if you want to use that rubric, you're welcome to just copy and paste that up here. All my stuff is Creative Commons attribution. Okay, poster projects. Like poster projects, because you get to put stuff on the walls, gets an audience, other people can see it, there's that networking idea, there's that publication idea, but the walls of the school, I feel, has an audience that's too small. If the audience is anything less than the world, the audience isn't big enough. So what can we do? Now here's another example, okay? So my son, this is my son, he's grade 7. They read this book in English Language Arts. This is Underground to Canada, and it's the story of two little girls, June, Lily, and Liza, who are slaves, two little black girls. They're slaves in Virginia, and they escape to Canada through the Underground Railroad, and the book is their story. Now, he came home one day, and he said, okay, I have this assignment based on the book. And it's small, and I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, but essentially what it says is the kids had to create a map that shows all the locations, you know, all the different cities or stops that June, Lily, and Liza made on their journey to freedom, okay? And it shows the routes that they took as they traveled from one city to another. And when I looked at how the assessment worked, so relevance to the novel was 10 marks, creativity, based on assortment of materials and an interesting map, was 15 marks, and accurate labeling of locations is 5 marks, and my son isn't an artist. I look at that, and I'm like, oh. So he's behind the eight ball, like, right off the hop. Half the marks are for the quote-unquote creativity. So I said, okay. And then the other thing was he had to make a map, right? And then he shows me the book, and this is on the first page. That's a map, and it tells me every place that June, Lily, and Liza were. They started in the Henson Plantation. They traveled to number 2, the Riley Plantation, and so on and so forth. So I'm like, well, what exactly is this assignment? To recopy this map, but do it pretty? And my son's not an artist. So I'm like, damn. Like, and this is the Underground Railroad, slavery. Like, I want my kid to learn about stuff like that. It's important. Everybody, every citizen should know that. So I said, okay, go talk to your teacher and see if you can get permission to do like the same assignment, but maybe a digital version. Maybe we can do it on a Google Map. So he goes and he talks to the teacher, and the teacher says, sure, no problem, go ahead. So here's what I really ticked off my son. He wants to build a Google map. And I said, the first thing I want you to do is just take out a Word document. And for each of those locations on the map, just 2 or 3 sentences of what happened in the story there. And for those journeys, like from this point to that point, just 2 or 3 sentences of what happened to June, Lily, and Liza on that part of the journey, so that you have this list of stuff. He says, okay, fine. So he sits down for a couple hours and works at it over a couple of days. He gets it all done. Finally, he's done. He says, okay, good, Dad, now, map. I'm like, no. Now, you're going to go to Flickr. Flickr is a photo sharing website. And I teach him how to search in the Creative Commons archive. How many people know what Creative Commons is? Okay, so when you produce something, anything, you own the copyright on it. And no one's allowed to use that stuff without your permission. Now, there is and that's circle C, right? It's copyrighted. You don't have to even do that. You don't have to put it like, you built it, you made it, it's yours. No one can use it without your permission. But some people don't care. Like, usually, if you took a picture and a kid emails you and says, I'm doing this school project, do you mind if I put it on a class blog, would that be all right? I mean, yeah, 99 people out of 100. I said, sure, go ahead, fine, right? But it's a hassle. So what you can do instead is put circle CC, Creative Commons, creativecommons.org. If you want to find out more online. And there's a number of licenses. The basic one is attribution. Just say who you bought it from. Then non-commercial, go ahead and use it, but you can't make a buck from it. Share alike. So, well, you can go ahead and use my stuff, but then you have to put this license on it as well, share the love, so that other people can share whatever you create with it. And then there's something called non-derivative, which means you can use my stuff, but you gotta use it as is. Don't make any modifications to it. Does that make sense? So on all the stuff that my students do that I do online, I give away everything, all my stuff is online, you'll find it easily. We put attribution, non-commercial, share alike. Say you got it from us, you can't make a buck from it. You want to make a buck, talk to us, we'll figure something out. And share alike. Whatever you do with it, put this same license on it so other people can also do new things with it.
Amanda Romquist.
So I taught him how to search Flickr. It's really just a matter of like clicking a button, and then you get only pictures that are licensed Creative Commons. Yeah. So he goes to search Creative Commons, and all those places on the map, he actually knows what they look like, because he found pictures of those locations. Not only that, there was one point where he finds a picture of a slave auction block. Like someone took a picture of what it looks like, the block where they make slaves stand when they were selling them. There's a picture he's got of the Emancipation Proclamation signed by President Lincoln. Okay. So he finds all that stuff. And then he says, okay, Dad, now I've got the pictures. Now the map? No. Now he goes to YouTube. And on YouTube, I have to search for the Underground Railroad. And for each of those locations, he should find a video, or as many as he can, about the slave trade, about the Underground Railroad, and coming to Canada. He finds like so many tens and tens of videos on the slave trade and the Underground Railroad. He spends hours watching videos on the Underground Railroad, many of them being projects that other students have made about the Underground Railroad. Do you think any learning's going on when this is happening? Right? And then he pulls out a couple of them that he wants to include in his project. And he says, now, Dad, the map? Yeah, now the map. So here's what the map looks like. My son's name is Cass. If you follow up on this, by the way, and you decide on your own time to come look at the map, down at the bottom, where is it? There's a place where you can leave a comment on the map. If you want to say something nice to my son, that would be really nice. But anyway, so here's the map that he made. So the Henson Plantation is where June Lilly grew up. And so you can see here, I'm going to pull out a bit. So this is his summary of what happened to her there. There's a picture of what that area of that area of Virginia looks like. And then he finds a video and he links to it. And then over here, he has another picture and he tells the story. And this is, he's clicked on the line, right? The path. You can label what every line does and what every pin does. And so on and so forth. By the time we get to the end, they end up in Canada. And they end up here. This is the last pin on the map. And this was Cass's idea. No, this was not my prodding. He says, I don't know if you can read that. He says, click me last. No, really. Read everything else on the page. And then if you really read it all, scroll down. So if we scroll down a little bit and says, no, really. Only if you've read everything else, scroll down. If not, leave this tab immediately. So this is my son's sense of humor. He's actually hilarious. And then you get to the end. It says, click here. You see, what happened was he found all these pictures and videos and stuff that didn't make their way into the project, but he didn't want to let go. So he archived them on another website called a proto page, and these are the pictures that he finds on Flickr that he didn't get a chance to put in his project. That's the slave auction block. That's the Emancipation Proclamation. He's got videos that he finds on YouTube of other kids' projects on this stuff. So his little map project turns into this. And so that's, he's in grade 8 now. He was in grade 7. It was the beginning of grade 7 he did this. He's towards the end of grade 8 now. And the other point that I wanted to make about that is oftentimes we think that the stuff that kids do on paper, is that's concrete, right? You could hold that. Digital stuff, that's ephemeral. Fades away. Mind you, the stuff my students did 5 years ago on paper, the projects that they did for me, handed in, I got a mark, they got 90% or something, I give it back, wham, it ends up in the trash, or maybe they put it away, but I don't know where it is now 5 years later, and I suspect neither do they. The digital stuff my kids did 5 years ago is still online, and it's going to stay online, and anybody can find it now, and chances are their grandchildren will be able to find it. So the notion that digital is ephemeral is questionable. It's not been my experience anyways. Welcome to challenge me on that. Presenting project work, like when kids do projects. As a matter of fact, in my department, teachers said that the deepest learning happened among students in our school was when they worked for an extended period of time on some kind of project. Have you had a different experience? Has that been, how many people have that? When you give the kids a project to do, get some good stuff out of them. Okay. So I started thinking the same thing, but I wanted to apply these ideas that I was talking to. So here's what they do. It's a capstone project. It takes the whole semester for them to work on this. Very quickly, here's the project. You must create 4, if you're working alone, 5 problems if you're in a pair of 2, if you're a group of 3, 6 problems, and you can't have 4 people in a group because 4 people is a social occasion, not a working group. 3 or less is a working group. And you'll notice also that a kid working alone has to do 4 problems, but 2 kids have to do 5, and 3 kids have to do 6. I want them to work together. But if they choose to work alone, that's their option to do that. So they have to create, not copy, 4, 5, or 6 original problems. They have to then solve those problems. They then have to annotate that solution well enough for an interested learner to learn from them. And then they have to publish it online in whatever format they like. I don't care. And I have a blog where they aggregate all the stuff. So oftentimes kids go, they create blogs and websites, whatever it is that they do, but they then have to link to it from like the main blog where it's all housed, all the kids' stuff. Now, when I taught these kids on the left, mathematics is the science of patterns. It's like one of the things I say over and over again to my kids, right? Like, computation is to mathematics what the alphabet is to literature. Mathematics is not computation, right? Mathematics is the science of patterns. It's about finding the underlying pattern. So part of my thinking behind this was, so a kid takes a class, let's say, in history. And by the time they get to the end of their course, they should probably know something about what it is that historians do. If they take a literature course, then they should probably know something about what literary critique is or how, what an author does. If they take a science course, they should, when they're done, they should know something about what it is that scientists do. And if they take a math course, then they should know something about what it is that mathematicians do. Which left me wondering...
Excuse interruption. Mr. Baker, could you please report to the small IITV lab? Mr. Baker, could you please go to the small IITV lab?
What is it that mathematicians do? And they don't sit around figuring all day. Right? Mathematics is not computation. What mathematicians do is they create mathematics. So I had my students create mathematics, 4, 5, or 6 problems. Right? And then publish them. This particular group of teachers decided that they were going to do the whole thing in Halo. So Halo, how many people know what that is? It's a video game. Right? And one of the features, it's a video game that you can actually play with other people across the internet. And one of the features in the game is there's like a camera view, so that it looks like this camera zooming around watching your characters move through the game, in the game world. And so they videoed their characters that they made up running around in the game world, getting themselves into trouble, and then they stop because now in order to get out of this problem, they have to solve the pre-calculus problem that the kids made up. And so they made a character that was me, and some other kid voiced me, and I would kind of send them off on missions looking for this secret something or other, and then they come back, report to me, we finish that, and then the whole thing ends, it's a cliffhanger. It's like, because these kids knew they were going to take grade 12 math with me the next year, so they knew they were going to get this project again, so it ends, you have to come back and see us next year. Yeah. The other one, the one on the right, Devious, that was a calculus class. Those kids, there's 3 kids, so they made 6 videos, they created 6 original calculus problems, put them in some kind of context, and actually in the end, it was 6 YouTube videos that they made, okay? That described the problems in depth, all the things that I talked about. The one on the bottom is 2 girls, so they did 5 problems, and what they did, remember the movie Across the Universe? Right? It's kind of like they remixed a whole bunch of Beatles songs and told the story of this character, Jude, as he travels to the United States from England, has all these life problems, whatever. So they wrote his diary. And in his diary, he comes, like, these problems arise, right? There's one point in the movie where he takes strawberries and he pins them up on a wall, and he's an artist, right? And it's like, I guess that's his art or whatever. So what they did was they found little video clips from YouTube, strung those together, and they write his diary, and when that thing where he pins the strawberries, okay, that became a problem in combinatorics that they then had to solve, Jude has to solve in order to move on to the rest of his story. So I'll show you what some of these look like. So this is like the calculus one. I'll just watch just a little bit, we won't watch the whole thing.
Steps up to the plate at Fenway Park in the bottom of the 9th with the bases loaded and down 3 points to the Boston Red Sox. Just as the ball makes contact with Bonds' bat, 71 meters above him, a bird is flying with the velocity of -sin t. Bonds hits the game-winning grand slam and the crowd goes nuts, but the bird is not so happy as the ball hits straight for him. What is the bird's instantaneous acceleration when the ball hits the bird? The first step of the solution is to anti-differentiate the velocity function to get the position function.
So speed up the video, they're both wearing white shirts.
Next, on the body of the Pentecost music points.
They underlay the whole thing with music, et cetera. It's kind of neat what they did. And, of course, the next time I teach calculus, this is the problem. And that's another nice thing about this, is the kids are creating original problems, so you never run out of stuff, right? Let them do it. I'm a big believer, right? Like, why should I do it when I get the kids to do it, right? If I'm the hardest person in the room, the person in the room that should be working the hardest is them. If it's not them, then I'm doing something wrong. So, anyways, this is another one. So this is an applied math class. This student, 5-minute video, it's a little bit melodramatic. He does the whole thing in the video. He transcribes the whole series on a blog that he does as well.
I woke up on Saturday afternoon. I lived a great life, but it hadn't always been that way. There was a girl back home, Lynn. She could steal the sun out of the sky. I almost proposed. I heard it said that when fate comes knocking, it's too late to board your windows. Cue the draft, and I thought I'd never see her again. There was the younger guy in my squadron, Mikey. He was all right. He thought he was a mathematician. I reckon he was right. Most days he'd bust in and tell me, I don't know, how unlucky I was being born when I was born. How I was statistically more likely to be drafted, like it mattered then. Some days he'd have interesting war math. He got his info from some mole on the other side. Turns out the opposing army received one new squadron of 50 soldiers every 5 weeks, and each soldier received one rifle and 100 rounds on the first day, and for every tomorrow, they received 90% of what they received today.
Okay, so now we're into like a geometric sequences problem, and so on and so forth, right? And you don't even know. Like, it's very melodramatic, right? Very high school, the story that he tells. But it was kind of a neat thing that he did together. It's a 5-minute long video. Anyways, the following year, the kids, like, it became, these projects became like major productions. Like, so the deadline, I would tell them the absolute deadline is this, usually just before the final exam. And then I would say, okay, here's the absolute deadline, but that's not the date you should choose for your deadline. Because what I want you to do is think about all the other courses you're taking, if you're working, if you have outside of school commitments, whatever it is, and pick a deadline that works for you, makes sense in the context of your life. And but once you've chosen that deadline, then that's it. That's when your project has to be handled in. You can't come in late. No discussions about that. I'll have to tell you this, though, that of course, you know, it happens. And when the kids come to me and they say, Mr. K, and they work really hard on this stuff. I've never seen kids work so hard. Mr. K, I need another day. Just one. I need one more. And I'm like, okay, why? Why weren't you able to make the deadline? And we have this conversation back and forth. And I say to them, so if I give you this extra day that you say you need, does that mean I'm going to get the very best work you're absolutely capable of doing? That this is going to be the utmost limit of your capabilities? That you are going to knock my socks off? You're going to allow me? And they say, yeah. I say, okay. You can have 3 days, right? And that's typically my formula, okay, what I do with the kids. Anyway, so it becomes like a production thing. And the kids, before that deadline, they start releasing teasers of like what's coming and creating posters and stuff. And they start publishing them on cloud. This is one of the teasers.
My name is Mary. Mary had a little, so you can call me 003.14. I'm your everyday schoolgirl with a not-so-everyday secret. I'm a student by day and a secret agent by night. But now the world's in danger and I gotta work overtime.
Thing. So then I had these kids, they were with me, MITSOP, right, Mathematics is the Science of Patterns. So these kids, one of those kids actually ends up dropping the class, a new kid comes into the group.
Brady Sutton to the office, please, Brady.
The reason they call it Calculus Survivor Islands is when we started in September, we had 19 kids in the class, and 10 kids wrote the final exam, but everybody survives. So this is the way they did their teaser for Calculus Survivor Islands.
Thank you.
With all that said, now it's your turn. Okay? So it's up to you. Now, I should have said it in the beginning, and I didn't say it now. I heard this wonderful quote by Mark Twain. He says, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. So don't look at any of the stuff that you saw today and say, hey, I did this in my class, and I'm going to copy that into my class, because everybody's different. And every class is different, and even for me, from one class to the next, okay, I'll try to do things a little bit different, right? Don't we all? So don't try to copy what I do, but kind of look at it, maybe you might rhyme, right? You might find your own way. Don't do it all. It's too much for one person to do all in one go, but you may do it over time. Don't suffer from functional fixity, right? Things don't have to, like, the tool is built to do a particular thing, and maybe use them in other innovative ways. So here's just a little bit of advice about thinking about how you might want to do something like this. Kate said that a computer is an instrument whose music is composed of ideas. There's lots of cool things, ideas that you can explore and create stages for your kids to share their ideas in a very, very public way. And don't get too hung up on looking at tools. This is a website called Web 2.0 Cool Tools for Schools, and if you're looking for a presentation tool, there's about 10, you click on that button, and there's tens of them. Videos, slideshows, converters, quizzes and polls, collaborative tools, drawing tools, audio tools. Like, don't worry about having figured all these tools. And you know what? You don't have to know any of them. Just tell your kids, there's a website, off you go. Whatever you need, figure out how you want to present your work, and there's whatever tool you want to shape a stick at, it's there and more. So, and on the slides on the website, you click on this page and it'll take you to this wiki. So there it is, cooltoolsforschools.wikispaces. And if you click on any of those buttons, it's here on the side. So if you wanted to see video tools, and then that will take you to all the different video tools that you can use and with a little write-up about what it's about. Okay? 3 instructional design practices. Create galleries of your students' thought so that you can see what they think, they can see what they think, and they can see what you think. Remember that when you publish the work, really good things can happen. Some lessons you can't even plan for. And if you remember 1620, how will you know what they know? Well, when they create content that educates, then you'll know what they know. Now, how many people have heard of the K-12 Online Conference? Okay. K-12onlineconference.org, again, that slide is clickable. It's a conference. I started this with some colleagues in 2006, so it's 4 years in now. Fifth year is going to be this fall. What it is basically teachers doing all this kind of stuff from all over the world. They create these presentations and they put them online in this conference, and there's 4 strands, a week in the classroom, where you can see how teachers are using a lot of these ideas concretely, step by step, in the classroom. There's one, like, if you need to know a particular tool or something, social bookmarking, wikis, whatever it is, there's a strand called tools, and you can learn all about a specific tool. That's what you're interested in. Doing this stuff isn't easy, because you've got to involve stuff like this. There's hardships with doing some of this. There's a whole strand in the conference called Overcoming Obstacles. There was a later on involvement to a strand called Kicking It Up a Notch. If you've been doing it for a while, you're looking for the next step, you can look at kicking it up a notch. And then for teacher leaders, or administrators, or principals, like, how do you facilitate this happening in your school so that it's easy for your students and teachers to work like this? So a whole strand of the conference. Okay, so that's, you can see that. With that said, I'm done.